Welcome to a special episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. Today is the first anniversary of this podcast. 1 year ago, on 22nd June 2022, the first episode came out with this description. Evening, June 22nd, 1941. In what is now Lithuania, cows, horses, and sheep sleep or lazily crop grass. The neat farmhouses are dark. Crops sprout in the fields. As the day ends, if anyone's listening to radios in the cities, dance music plays. The longest day of the year leads, naturally, to the shortest night. At just past 3 a.m., the first glimmers of light appear on the eastern horizon, tinting faint orange and yellow. Far overhead, the drone of airplanes, bombers, pass toward the east. At precisely 3:05, the loudest thunder ever heard bursts the bucolic calm. Dawn becomes bright as midday for an instant, before it is swallowed by black smoke. In the words of one who was there, it is as if the jaws of hell have opened. Peaceful fields are torn apart by exploding bombs and shells. Airplanes scream lower to drop thousands of fragmentation explosives on unprepared defenders. This is the opening of Operation Barbarossa, the greatest land invasion in the history of humanity. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting to you today, as always, from the Red Beard Studio, located on a part of Algonquin Anishinaabe territory now called Ottawa, Canada. Today is the first anniversary of this podcast, as I said. And that's why I delayed the release of this episode, number 29, not counting the bonus episodes, delayed it just a few days from Monday to this, to coincide with the 83rd anniversary of the launch of Operation Barbarossa, the greatest land invasion in history, when Nazi Germany attacked its temporary ally, the Soviet Union. So in addition to being a double anniversary of that operation and this podcast's launch, what makes this episode special is my special guest. He's one of my favorite podcasters, one of those who inspired this podcast, a man who's visited the war front in Ukraine multiple times over the past 15 months, and even rode a Ukrainian tank. The Righteous Regan, the one and only Kristaps Andersens, podcaster of the Eastern Border. Welcome, Kristaps. Kristaps, please introduce yourself by telling everyone about your podcast and how you got started.
I was in college doing my bachelor's in history a long time ago. I think it was 2013 or something. Oh, it's been 10 years already. Wow. And I was listening to podcasts, Dan Carlin's Hardcore History specifically, which I found because some random person had put it in our college group's study kind of web server with other stuff on it. And I discovered Dan Carlin's show. And then, you know, I had a bunch of studies for my bachelor's thesis about how people served in the Soviet Army. You know, all the studies, weird stories, weird anecdotes, basically.
During the Second World War or after?
After that, I spoke with veterans too, but that was a bit later. But It all started with the people, you know, my parents' generation aged, I don't know, about 55 to 65 at this point.
Yeah,
because I'm 33, and I had collected a lot of studies. So I had collected a lot of studies about this, and I just translated them into English and posted them on the Dan Carlin forums. And then Dan told me that I should make a podcast. And I did. And turns out no one else was doing this at the time. Turns out I was the very first podcast in the Baltic States. And then it kind of escalated from there. And, well, I just take my job seriously. That's all that I do these days. It started out because of this random chance that I was listening to Dan Carlin back in 2013. Yes.
Was it originally called the Eastern Border?
Yes, it was. The Eastern Border was there because I thought about, you know, at that point, every podcast had to have a catchy name because we're talking about the era where YouTube was just starting to appear and grow big. And when podcasts were just popping out on the iTunes stage and everything, And I wanted to have something thematic for my show. At that point, remember, I was listening to Hardcore History, also a very kind of strong name, right? So I wanted to pick something meaningful. So Eastern Border came out because I view Latvia as an eastern border of the European Union. That's my logo represents the fact that this is the border between the EU and Russia and that whole other post-Soviet thing, both physically and sort of metaphysically in a way, because we have been trying to restore our place among the Western nations, which we held in the interwar period, and that this was taken away from us, and now we're trying to build it back. So we're on this border between being post-Soviet and being Western. And again, it's both geographically and metaphysically. And also, it was nice that I started the podcast while I was living literally 20 kilometers from the Russian border as well. So it all just seemed to kind of fit and click into my mind. And there was a long time ago, I remember there was some TV show, but that was about country music or something. I don't know. I don't remember. I remember just watching this show as a kid, and it was called Austrumrobeža, which is Eastern Border, but Latvian. And that wasn't trademarked. And it just kind of, when I was thinking about this name, I found the meaning. And then it just kind of struck me that I had seen this short-lived TV show about Latvian country music. It had like, I don't know, 10 episodes maybe or something. And then I just adapted that to English. And yeah, that's why it is called the Eastern Border. And I also picked happiness is mandatory because
I love that.
it is also, again, I try to put some meaning into all of this. Back in the day, everything had to be quite meaningful. That's why I call all my listeners comrades, and why I have this, well, bit improved currently, but like kitschy theme song. And I, kind of play up the kitsch elements of the Soviet era, because it started out a bit about Soviet life, because there's a in Soviet Union they made a lot of good comedies, a lot of good comedy movies, and there was one of these jokes which went like, "What are you laughing about? We're laughing about ourselves, basically." So this ability to laugh about yourself and take these dark concepts and dark things and turn them into a way that is not exactly very depressing. I think that's one of my strengths of my show. I started out doing this as a means of keeping myself, more or less sane, because I'm constantly talking about, and even now with the war, about personal tragedies that have happened to me and things that have impacted me a lot. And this way is it all comes from the Ashkenazi culture, from the Eastern European Jews, and they invented all the political jokes in the Soviet Union. So this whole self-depreciation and this gallows comedy, in a way, it's not there to mock anything. It's there to just, to be able to look at these things with a somber, sober eye, and just keep your cool, so to speak. That's my podcast and tagline and everything. I hope this helps a bit.
So your podcast is about the Eastern Front, or sorry, the Eastern Border, and my podcast is about the Eastern Front. So we have one word in common at least.
Well, yeah, the Eastern Front went over our country very brutally and harshly. Oof.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. We've all heard how foundational or how formative the Great Patriotic War is in today's Russian culture. How is it perceived, or is it still such a bear such a big presence in current Latvian culture?
Well, yes, it does. For example, one of the elements that was brought to the forefront was the Soviet Victory Monument that we demolished last year because of the whole invasion thing. Because it turned away from being a monument for the war and against the Nazis, it was just, it had become, since Putin's dishonorable and despicable actions, a temple of imperialism and chauvinism. I mean, what sort of a victory monument in World War II can you have if every year Putin's supporters gather there and they wave Russian imperial flags next to Soviet flags? That makes no sense. It was at that point, it had become basically no longer about the whole victory thing, no longer about war, but about Russian imperialism. I personally spotted the fact that, when they started the Immortal March back in 2008, back then they truly carried the pictures of their dead, and I can respect that. even though we've suffered a lot from them, it was still a brutal war, and I understand very much the nuances of the whole situation there. And I can respect that. But at one point, you know, I believe that it switched over from being a monument designated to Soviet victory to something completely else at the moment when they no longer started getting their own family pictures. They just started throwing them out at the end of their walk. That was bad. But it got demolished because of the whole, you know, because of the war and the actions that the Russians undertook against Ukraine. And it was seen as a major event here. Because, again, this monument, it was built in 1985 to kind of commemorate the 40th anniversary of the end of the war, World War II. And yeah, it had been there because for us in the Baltics,
there goes right.
Victory in the war for the Soviets did not really mean anything that good.
No.
And everyone really suffered from all this. For us, it meant loss of our freedoms, loss of our sovereignty, loss of our identity as people. Well, attempted loss. We managed to keep it somehow. But it was something that for us, the 8th of May, the end of the war in Europe, is a memorial date because a lot of people have died from everywhere. And it was kind of weird to see how these pro-Putin people turned it into a massive celebration. And you know, when I was growing up, my grandmother told me always that everyone, you know, my grandfathers also were participants of the war. And they always drank at this date and said, you know, let's just have this never again. You know, let's never repeat this. And then at one point, again, it all shifted to Можем повторить, you know, we can repeat this. And
it just twisted. We can have another victory.
Yeah, that's the Russian thing that they're doing now with all this stuff. We can go to Moscow once again. And yeah, that's how it's all shifted. But again, I'm telling you this story because this whole aspect of what the war meant, what it was, and everything that happened in it with our country and with the Soviet Union, that's remained central to this day, I suppose. And to an extent that I would even call that we should probably move on from it a bit. It's left a massive scar in our society. Because... and we'll get to on this, I suppose, in the further questions, but it truly decimated our demographics completely, like our economy, and it was just pretty horrible. Like, truly one of the most horrific things that could happen, and I cannot overstate the impact of World War II and its end and what happened during this whole fighting that was here, because we are the borderlands, bloodlands, if you like Timothy Snyder's version of the whole story, but it is true. It is true.
Yeah.
It is something that, you know, it speaks a lot when basically the whole war, World War II and its effect changed our national culture quite a lot. It changed how people view themselves, how they view Western world, how they view everything. Like, because I've studied interwar period and stuff before that, and it was a kind of a cultural shift, so to speak. It truly was something so horrific that it changed a lot about how people view the world here in Latvia. We used to view, for example, the Russians as our natural allies.
Right.
All the way before that, we didn't have much hatred towards them, even when the revolution broke out in 1917. We didn't like the Germans much more. Germans and the British too, by the way. But now that shifted because of all the weird things. And yeah, it's left a tremendous scar. I'm just, you know, explaining a bit more because I believe it's important to bring some context and some personal message into this whole situation, because, you know, you can write, you can read in many books about how this was important and a crucial event, but to truly understand what it means, you kind of have to put yourself in the shoes of the people who lived through it, and you have to have some understanding on some empathic level to understand the trauma, I think, at least.
In Ukraine in 1941, on the invasion of Operation Barbarossa, it has become kind of a trope that a lot of Ukrainian people initially welcomed the German invaders as liberators from communism and Stalin. Did a similar thing happen in Latvia?
Exactly the same thing. Exactly. Okay. is because 1940 is known in our culture as the horrid year.
When the Soviet Union invaded.
When the Soviet Union came in, yes, because of all of the murders and exiles and being sent to Siberian gulags and everything. And at that point, yeah, well, not like Hitler advertised his plans on everything. Yeah. He treated us quite nicely. So yeah, we truly did greet him as a liberator, because what Stalin did to us was so horrid that people just, you know, those who had survived, and they volunteered in droves to go and fight Bolshevism, because not like we had a choice. I mean, at that point, there were no allies even near us in any position.
No.
So these people, a lot of them volunteered, and their tragedies also is one of the things that forms all of my nation. Because imagine this, Stalin comes in and shoots, destroys, kills, murders a lot of your family members. Your family members are all dead, and you're happy to survive. And then Hitler comes in and says, well, of course we're going to restore independent Latvia. He obviously lies there, because he wanted to turn us into a servant race, basically. But, you know, people just were grasping at some stroke to, you know, fight against Bolshevism. And then they go to the front lines, and they find out that their friends now are being murdered by the same guy who promised liberty.
Right.
And then they come back, those who survived after the war in 1949, and then there's a second wave of persecutions by Stalin.
Ah, right.
It's a massive tragedy, because we lost approximately, in Latvia at least, we lost 40% of our male population.
Wow. In those 8 years.
During World War II, yes.
Okay.
From both sides together, from both Stalin's side and Hitler's side, like, we lost so many people, which is why we still have demographical issues, because it leaves a scar, it leaves a mark.
Right.
It was just horrid, because so many people died or emigrated that we still haven't gotten over it in the demographical sense, same as Ukraine and Russia. And, right. You know, not like, of course, there were also fanatical Nazis in Latvia. I'm not denying that we had our own share of collaborators, you know, people who actually genuinely wanted to play by the Nazis' rule book and who actually murdered Jews. We have the infamous Arais squad as well.
Arais, is that the Forest Legion?
No. Forest guys are Konstantin Shaksa, who are like against everyone. Arais squad is one of those Einsatzgruppen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we also had those. We're not denying that. But what I consider important to mention is that at no point anyone here was, at least for the most part, was a fan of Nazism as an ideology. They just, you know, they wanted to fight against Stalin. And right. important evidence to this is the fact that Latvian Legion members, the guys who volunteered for the SA units in the Wehrmacht, they served as guards in the Nuremberg trials. They weren't judged, they were literally used as guards, and they guarded the war criminals, because you know, if as I've spoken to veterans when I managed to get them, that was some years ago, I do not know if they are still alive at this point, but well, like they told me,
not many.
it was because, you know, if you have at that point, and also I've spoken to, because we have these studies here in Latvia, in the Baltics, and Estonia, Lithuania as well, where one part of your family gets conscripted into the Red Army, other part in you know, the Nazi army to fight against the Reds. And that was my story as well. My stepfather's dad fought for the Reds. And my other grandfather, well, he was conscripted to build roads for the Germans. He didn't shoot anyone, but he was conscripted to do that thing. Yeah. So it was just... And still, after the war, they didn't hate each other. It was because they're all Latvians at the end, and... many people, even on both sides, till the end of their days, have always told me that it's not like we loved any of them. To us here in the Baltics, they both were utter monsters. But
right,
so you had to pick one. You had to pick something. You had to pick something that you believed would be a bit more merciful towards you and your family, and figure something out later. It was the option to resist everyone was a naive one for such a tiny country as Latvia or Estonia or Lithuania. You had to fight for a monster, right. One or the other one. It was just that. It is just very brutal if you think about it these days. And then it's kind of hard to explain to the people when when you know, this is why we still hold.
We here in the West who've known, really, like, historically speaking, luxury since 1945. Going on from that, then, since the Soviet Union fell apart in the 90s, mm-hmm. how has Latvia fared economically?
Well, it's been rough. It's been rough because, once again, a lot of our population is Russian. About 20-30%. That's because of the policies that the Soviet Union did, mm-hmm. where if you would finish college, they would send you to the other end of the Soviet Union to serve, to work there for some years, maybe make a family or something. If you were conscripted into the army, then you all would also serve as far from home as humanly possible. And they had a policy towards all, not just Latvia, but towards all the national republics, as they were called, you know, mm-hmm. all the Georgia, Kazakhstan, everywhere. Yeah. They had a systematic policy where they would try to make the local people, the native people of the area, a minority in that area. They treated us very much like, well, I don't know, it's kind of hard to put it in words, but basically, I like to compare us in the Baltics here and many other people like, I don't know, the First Nations people felt when the colonizers came, because right. that was our fate, basically. And I feel much more in common with those people because this is our ancestral home. It's not like we went anywhere. This is where we are. This is where this is. This is our land. And we have such a, we still have our pagan festivals and tribes and everything. And we had this aspect where everything in Soviet Union was done in Russian. And just like in Ukraine, our language was suppressed, our traditions were suppressed, our culture was suppressed. We were second-rate citizens. There are Soviet claims of equality among men and like all this good stuff that they promised. It was nothing but a charade, nothing but a farce and a lie, because it was all, you know, you either become Russians and assimilate or else. That was it. And this is why, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we still had a lot of people here who actually believed this ideology, because the Russian people in the Soviet Union, they only felt the economical impact of this. They only felt the fact that we had planned economy and like hardcore socialism. And in my sense of socialism, in which I don't mean social democracy, I have to explain this to your American listeners probably. I mean the kind of socialism where there's literally zero private property, where they take away your cow. And so the issue was that a lot of the Russians who had, you know, lived very comfortably here and hadn't learned our language and everything, they chose not to learn our language. They didn't want to. They thought at one point that the Soviet Union might come back. And right. because of various issues, including corruption and greed, in Latvia and in Estonia, we did not give citizenship automatically to people, to everyone who was like living here. We gave it to the, by the, what was this, the blood principle, that citizenship was granted automatically only to those who were citizens in the first independent country and to their relatives. So it was a bit of a mess. And now you had to
be a Latvian citizen in 1939.
Or a direct descendant, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Now, it's a bit weird now, but at that point, yeah, that was probably... At that point, my government thought it would be a good idea because they were worried that the Soviet Union actually might return, and that was kind of a preventive measure, but it turned out to be a great mistake because that has split up our society. Again, like everything, it's a bit of a double-edged sword here.
Yeah.
But a lot of these people, once we joined the EU, a lot of these people who, you know, because they didn't speak Latvian, they couldn't get actual decent jobs, and their kids and everything. A lot of them moved to Ireland and Holland. We lost a bunch of population once again due to immigration. Right. Now this process has stopped, but you know, it still exists. But economically speaking, we could do better, but I'd say we're doing okay now.
Joining the EU, has that been a positive?
Yes, okay. I'd say it's a positive. It's only a long-term positive because,
yeah,
for one, regulations are awful. That's the one thing that I will give to the Brexit people in Britain. Regulations are terrible, and Brussels gets on your nerves a lot. the whole thing is that we had to shift systems. We had to adapt. We had like this reconstruction period, but now we're doing okay. The biggest thing that changed was this everyday corruption. You know, back before we joined the EU, it was still pretty much normal to just, you know, if you have a speeding ticket, then you just pay like 10 lats at that point, our currency, to the cops, and you could like bribe your way out of this. Yeah, and the EU changed that very slowly, and right now we're trying to kind of adapt to this. One big issue that we have here in Latvia and that I'm trying to fight against due to the fact that I've actually spent some time, you know, abroad. In a lot of places in the West, you see a lot of these mom and pop stores, you know, these little tiny stores everywhere. This is not a thing in Latvia at all. Very, very few of those stores exist. Everything's chain store because we still have this kind of stigma, kind of this... I call it post-Soviet mentality. The fact that if you start your own business, that's considered a bad thing. It's like it's not good because the business starting your own business is still associated with you know the 90s and the people who live there. Because well, I can speak from my generation's perspective. Again, I was born in 1989. I'm one of those Atmoor, the kids. You know, the collapse of the Soviet Union kids. And I can tell you that our parents wanted my generation to build a new capitalist democratic Western society here in Latvia.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they really wanted us to keep all the old Soviet values, you know, the things they've learned in school. Change things and build everything anew, but don't change too much.
Right.
And that's causing a lot of issues right now with a lot of our policies.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people who are doing things. I like to consider myself among them because of course, I've been lucky to do this, but at least, hey, I try to actually, you know, do my best here. But we're doing okay. We're doing fairly well. Currently, the median salary in Latvia is about 1,300 United States dollars
per month,
or about the same in euros. But also, our rent prices are ridiculously cheap. Like our healthcare is okay. For example, I live in an Art Nouveau style building, 15 minutes from the city center, in a three kind of room apartment, mm-hmm. with like those natural wooden floors, and it's a historical building. And I pay 450 euros plus bills per month.
Okay, I'm moving there because the housing prices here are insane.
That's the thing. See, Latvia in general, Latvia itself is, if you imagine this, we're about twice the size of Netherlands.
Right.
But Netherlands has a population of like what 16 million. That's half of Latvia. Latvia has a population of 2 million.
Yeah, it,
because of all the history,
really crowded.
Because of all the history and everything, you know, again, Stalinist regime and everything. Because of our low population number, Latvian countryside is super ridiculously cheap. That's a kind of another effect of the situation. So, also half of our population lives in our capital.
Right. That,
again, because of all the historical impacts, our property prices for real estate are just falling constantly. But yeah, I just wanted to show this that again, World War II impact still very very much felt this day because you know this last generation in the World War II who died off, they didn't make children, obviously. So that was also a kind of fall down, and this kind of you know repeats itself. And I hope that maybe in 20 years, 30. We will, you know, get back to our feet or something. Yeah, we're a tiny nation and we're proud of it. And we have forests, lots of forests, rain and misery. Best thing.
Forest, rain and misery. Okay. Kind of like hockey too. In the spring. Thanks for painting that picture of Latvia forest, Kristaps. Now, before we go on, I think this is a good point to take a short break. So audience, please come back with us in a few minutes for the rest of my conversation with Kristaps Andersens of the Eastern Border Podcast.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thank you, listeners, for coming back to part two of my conversation with Chris Stapps Andersens, host of the Eastern Border Podcast. Chris Stapps, you've described the historical impact of the Second World War on Latvia. I want to turn now to current events and your podcast. You've spent the last 15 months now, covering the invasion of Ukraine. Did you see that coming, the invasion in February 2022?
I saw that a war would come at some point. Specific dates? No.
Right.
But I can't tell you specific dates.
It's not a war. It's a special military operation.
Yeah, there's a joke about this too, by the way, which Igor Girkin, my favorite nemesis, mind you, has been telling recently. He says that, imagine this Soviet political joke. So in a huge ceremony in the Soviet, like late Soviet era or whatever, they're opening like a huge monument to Stirlitz from the 17 Moments of Spring. Great Soviet movie about spies. And like everything's happening very nicely and everything's awesome and the monument's being opened, but then a drone pops in and explodes. And then Stirlitz kind of, you know, cleans off his coat because he's a KGB agent who's sent in to spy on the Germans. And then he thinks to himself, war. But then, with a soft voice, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin corrects him. Comrade, special military operation.
Yeah.
It's all nonsense. Because, like, this has been going on since 2014, all this conflicts and everything. And even before that, if you look at Transnistria, for example, and the events in Georgia.
Yeah.
It's been a mess. And It's been a mess, especially since I believe it's some sort of inferiority complex of Putin himself. Because for one, you know, he wants to be like Stalin, but he's totally not like Stalin. Stalin did not have dachas in California. He did not have money abroad. He did not, you know, steal a bunch of money. He literally had money.
Well, he did steal money. He was a bank robber.
Well, in the early days, yes. But when he got power, Stalin simply did not need money in the Soviet Union.
Well, no.
Like, Stalin would let you know that he wants something and it would magically appear. Or else. that's how it operated. But he never had any duchess. And Stalin, out of all the things, this is a favorite thing of mine because I'm a bit of a nerd person. I like to compare Stalin and Hitler, for example, and now Putin as well. If you know Dungeons and Dragons, that game, have you heard of it?
The game, yeah.
Well, there are like this alignment system, which is based on law and like law versus chaos and good versus evil. So Stalin is lawful evil. He obeyed the rules and he was cold and calculating. Meanwhile, Hitler and Putin these days, they were chaotic evil.
Right.
There's a difference, you know. One is a chaotic force of destruction. Another one is a calculating sociopath. Does that make any of them good? Nope. But
they're still on the evil side of the ledger.
Yeah, except one of them is like very cold and calculating. And you know what? I think that Stalin, because I made a series about him.
That's how I was introduced to your podcast.
I didn't finish them, sadly, because a lot of things happened with the war and everything. But I truly believe the moment when Stalin said that when his first wife died from tuberculosis, when he wrote in his diary that, you know, all love towards humankind has gone away and the only thing that could melt his cold stone heart has now passed away, I believe that's the point when Koba or Mr. Djugashvili becomes Stalin. Now, see, Putin wants to be like that, but Putin, unlike Stalin, who always, you know, always wore the same coat and lived, you know, he had the best stuff and he liked to test people, but he never showed off any excesses. He was a man who was more private and I would say Stalin had way more gravitas. Oh, sorry, not gravitas, but dignitas. This dignity about his position and everything. Because, you know, for example, Stalin even refused to exchange his own son for a lieutenant, right? He was that dedicated to this whole situation, right? Can you imagine Putin sacrificing anything he owns to make the war in Ukraine end faster? Putin's just a criminal, a kleptocrat, and he wants to be Stalin, and he glorifies Stalin and makes him to be like some sort of a good guy. But to be honest, if Stalin would be alive today, then Putin would be among the people who'd be put to the wall first and shot instantly.
And there's an image that cheers me greatly. That sounds awful.
Look, comrade, sounding awful is okay. This is how it is. This is how it is. This is my tagline: is happiness is mandatory. I mean, you sort of have to accept the fact that everything can be terrible, and then you kind of have to figure out how to deal with it on your own.
Right.
And this is by the way a fresh chokhmah, how we call anecdotes and political jokes from Odessa, mind you, because all the Soviet political jokes that you know or maybe you don't know, all the ones that Reagan collected in the United States, right? They all come from one little city in Ukraine called Odessa, because that's where all the Ashkenazi Jews live, and they have a brand new one. And this is about Radio Yerevan. Radio Yerevan used to be a comedy radio show in the Soviet Union. It has nothing to do with Armenia. It ran in Moscow and in all the big cities. But it was called Radio Yerevan, and they were sending listener questions. So the traditional joke format is about Radio Yerevan or Armenian radio.
Okay.
But Radio Yerevan gets asked, what's the difference between Putin and Hitler? Radio Yerevan answers, Hitler did not call Jews a brotherly nation.
Okay.
It's dark, isn't it? It's really dark.
It's really, yes.
But that's the sort of thing. This is the attitude. Sorry about interjecting this, but like I said, it's a way how I deal with all the stress, you know, because I've lost 10 people in this war, for example, so far that I know personally. Yeah. And the Soviet era was traumatic. And this is a way how it might seem silly to some people, but people I also have talked about my podcast. People have told me that you should be more professional. But the problem is that if I do that, then I'll just, you know, go insane or something. I can't be the very cold, impassionate journalist. I kind of have to be the gonzo person here because I live through this whole situation. Yeah, really. I am inside it. I am as much as a participant as I am an observer. Therefore, I cannot simply remain on the sidelines. And this is why my show might not appeal to everyone who, you know, goes to it and expects a very academical analysis of the most recent events. But that's a way of coping with everything, to be honest, because it's something that I should do. And this is why I also kind of want to tell these jokes, because these jokes tell a lot about the whole Soviet society as a whole.
Right.
For example, the most favorite joke that I told to Americans, and maybe you guys will like it too, is this one. This is the most top-rated Soviet joke that I've heard from American perspective. So in the height of the Cold War, Nixon and Brezhnev, they're walking next to Niagara Falls. And they're arguing about everything, you know, whose country is better and everything like that. And at one point, they start to argue about who has the best bodyguard. And they decide to test it. So Nixon turns to his bodyguard and orders him, to just jump off into Niagara Falls. And the American bodyguard looks at Nixon and says, well, Mr. President, I can't do that. I have family and friends and loved ones. Then, they understand the message, everything's fine. And then Brezhnev turns to his bodyguard and says, you there, comrade, jump. And without hesitation, the Soviet bodyguard instantly just runs and starts jumping. And he's pulled off at the last moment, like the last second, and confused Nixon is just asking him, well, why did you do that? This is madness. And the Soviet bodyguard turns to Nixon and says, well, Mr. American President, I too have loved ones and family and friends.
That is dark. That's very dark.
That is dark. But that's the thing. This is why happiness is mandatory. All of our jokes are this way. This is kind of the thing. We it's a cultural thing, I suppose. We've grown up to this situation because when you're, as I was growing up in the 90s with mass crime and poverty everywhere, life was dark already, so we just kind of made fun of it. That was it. It's not like we try to shock people with it or anything. For us, it's just that it's sort of the normal thing.
You talked about the differences between the Second World War and the current situation, but do you see any similarities between what's going on now in Ukraine and what happened in between 1941 and 44 in Ukraine?
That's a good question. And I do not mean it in the way the politicians mean it. I mean it honestly. The thing is, the Russians think it's 1942 for them. You know, they're fighting the Battle of Stalingrad. At least Putin likes to put it that way. But they're actually fighting as Battle of Tsushima in 1905.
Oh.
That's how I view it. I think it's another Russo-Japanese war, to be honest. Except in place of Japanese, there are Ukrainians. If you look at this the same way, land. I mean, if you look at this, the whole propaganda is the same. The evil enemy that is also, you know, weak and miserable, natural Russian lands, all this stuff. Except at that point in the Japanese Russo-Japanese war, there was also a racial aspect, but it's also like popping up about, you know, how Russians call Ukrainians hohols. The biggest issue was the fact that, they lost that one. And the fact that how it's been moving into, like even the Gidkin says, it's turned into a positional war, because when I was on the front lines myself, you see, tanks don't move anywhere because they're too afraid of man pads. Tanks have their role to play. It's better to have a tank than not to have one. But tanks are all covered and hidden and sitting in the trenches themselves, and they are afraid to do some drastic maneuvers like in World War II. It's a positional war. Yeah, Ukrainian tanks as well, you know.
Oh, okay.
Same thing. Unless they make a breakthrough with more modern tanks, because one advantage that, for example, the Abrams tanks and Leopard tanks have over the T-90s is the fact that Leopards and Abrams tanks can actually fire precisely while moving. It's the fire control system that grants it the ultimate advantage. And an extra about 1.5 kilometers of range, too. It's just that the T-90 tank can theoretically shoot while moving, except it can't do it with any real accuracy. Abrams and Leopards can. It's a thing. The thing is all about training. It's all about quantity and all this stuff. But it's a very weird war, to the sense that you still need tanks for breakthroughs. You still have to risk them and put them through. But it has stopped being a mobile warfare war in general, because from the Russian perspective, at least, they have shown their complete inability to do any combined arms tactics, since they are focused on similar situation. Like I wrote about in the article with Prigozhin and Wagner Group, they continuously do the same World War II tactics. They still think it's World War II, these so-called meat assaults, as they name it, right?
Yeah.
And but this is the era of the combined warfare. So it all depends. Like Ukrainian success currently depends on whether or not they will learn how to pull off proper combined arms assaults against fortified positions. Because what happened in the Kharkiv Oblast, that was a counteroffensive. And that was also planned, obviously, but that was a way easier thing than to do the same against very fortified positions. Two different animals completely.
Yes.
So it's, you know, as a historian, of course, I like historical parallels, but at this point, it's currently the conflict is calcified, just like the Western Front did in World War I. And Bakhmut is kind of like Stalingrad, because it doesn't exist at this point even.
It's smaller.
Well, smaller, of course, but you know, if I had to put parallels somewhere, you know, it's just that from my perspective, there are way more parallels with other military conflicts than with World War II currently.
Ah, okay.
Although Russia would definitely like to, and they continuously do, by the way, portray this as another great patriotic war. Except then you have to ask the question of okay, then, but you know, who attacked whom and why? Because the whole idea that Ukraine, a nation without nuclear weapons, which they had given up voluntarily for protection of United States and Russia in 1994 with the Budapest memorandums, you know, I cannot imagine a non-nuclear state with like about 1/3 of the population of Russia actually attacking Russia. How does this even make sense? And secondly, they also claim that NATO was planning to attack Russia. Now, look. I might not be, you know, a military expert to such a degree. I have learned some things during this war, obviously, but if I was a general and if I wanted to attack Russia as a, you know, a part of NATO kind of process or something, then I would do this like two months ago or something. Like if NATO would want to attack Russia, they would have done it already. Because this is the moment, if anyone wants to attack Russia, this is the moment when to do it.
Yes.
So again, this is just objectively proven to be false. So I don't know. It's kind of like they play on these myths of World War II to themselves, but in earnest, it just kind of turns into a farce, you know. It's the same situation that, you know, history repeats itself. And once as a tragedy, once as a farce. And for example, when Igor Girkin opened a subsidiary of his Angry Patriots Club, which, by the way, is my trademark in European Union because I've managed to steal it from him and patent it. Yes.
Well done.
But basically, he opened a kind of a subsidiary of these Angry Patriots in St. Petersburg.
Ah.
And over there, they had National Bolsheviks on the scene with armbands and everything. And the only difference between the Nazi logo and the National Bolshevik logo is that Nazis had a swastika. National Bolsheviks have exactly the same everything else, except they have hand grenade and lightning.
Oh, that one. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I've seen that.
And then right. It's kind of like, it's kind of funny to look at, you know, people in brown shirts wearing red armbands that totally do not resemble anything, you know, and then they claim that they are the ones who are fighting against the Nazis in Ukraine, right?
Yeah.
It's just that it's a bit insane. And sorry about the random tangents. It's just that you're asking the questions that make me think a bit, and I can't give you simple answers because this war is not a simple affair. This is why I do my show. I just want to explain all this stuff to the West. I think that, you know, you should know. You should know, right. And you should understand.
Well, that it nicely leads me into my next question is, what is the one lesson that the West or the English-speaking world doesn't understand about the Second World War in the Baltic area?
Oh, okay. Second World War. In World War II, that thing... Yeah, one thing that I really is... which is why I haven't had an episode on my own show about the situation, is the whole fact about how we in the Baltics were actually, how we truly did see Hitler as liberator for a period. Mm-hmm. And the very fact that we started this conversation with, I still don't know how to make an episode about the Latvian Legionnaires who, yes, volunteered in Hitler's army to fight against Stalin and not get canceled instantly.
Right.
Because that's a big issue. And this is why I mentioned the Nuremberg trials and all the complexity that is in there. Because it's a thing. It's kind of like the West tries to forget oftentimes that, you know, it's always nice to be on the side of the good guys and then the good guys won.
Right.
But then there's this Stalin figure over there, you know, your ally and everything. And then people also try to forget that, you know, Stalin was allied to Hitler in the early war, and they actually held a military parade in Poland together and all this stuff. And for unknown reasons, winter war against Finland is somehow not included in World War II.
No.
Which also is really bizarre.
Yeah. I did three episodes on the winter war and...
I have a beer here. I'll quickly open it. Here's one to Simo Hauha.
Simo, a salute with my coffee.
Excellent.
Simo
is, if you don't know who Simo is, please leave it up. But there's a thing. It's like, kind of like I feel personally, and this is an emotional level.
The greatest sniper, just for the listeners to remind them.
Yeah.
Simo is a Finnish fighter, warrior, and the greatest sniper of the war, if not of all time.
He was, and he did everything without even an optical scope. Just
no, didn't like the optical scope, and he thought it would, the reflection off the glass lens would give him away.
We get taught this in school because, you know, it kind of resembles all of our region. If you think about it, he was a very humble man, very short farmer, never really showed any kind of ambitions, and was a very polite man. Up until his death in age 92, by the way. And he was just a humble little man. And when he was asked, you know, how he did so well, he said, well, you know, I was just doing what I was told and I did my best. Mm-hmm. Very humble and kind of inspiring person for all of us here in Eastern Europe. But the thing is that, this is the attitude that we kind of don't like. The fact that me as a Latvian and everyone in the Baltics, we're always put into this defensive position, you know. The fact that there is this one narrative, which has been written about like all the time, and even after the World War II, not like anyone likes Stalin. It's just that it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to go on and understand that, you know, there are more complexities to this, especially when it comes to my region, because again, Stalin came first and murdered a lot of people.
Right.
And then there's like, is the fact that I would like to stop apologizing for all these facts and you know, I just don't like to worry all the time constantly about the fact that if I make an episode on this, that I'll get instantly canceled because someone's definitely going to yell at me for defending Nazism or something, which is right. definitely not the case. Absolutely not the case. Right. That's the thing. Another thing, by the way, in World War II, our Latvian Legion, the guys who were these Latvian volunteers and conscripts too, because it was both ways, they surrendered after Hitler had died. The Kurland pocket held on like one of the very last places where fighting happened. And it happened for one single reason. So that as many people as humanly possible could escape to the West and surrender to the Allies. They did not even hope for anything at that point. They just had seen how horrible the Soviets were. And all they did was just hold the line for as long as possible against the Soviet Union so that as many people could take their little fishing boats, go to Gotland, and from there travel somewhere else and maybe have a chance of escaping the horrid Stalinist regime.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it way past beyond when there was a lost cause. Now, you gotta think with how horrid Stalin was to us for people to do this sacrifice. This is why we honor them, not because they fought for Hitler, which is how the Russian side tries to portray it, but because of this very fact that this fact alone proves that they didn't care about the ideology. They cared about, you know, trying to preserve as many Latvians as possible. And the same has to be said about people who fought for the Reds, because they too, as far as I've spoken with them, they also fought to preserve as many Latvians as they could. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of stories about the situation, and just that, as I quoted at the beginning, war walked all over us twice, and it was a humongous tragedy, and we are, in a way, as Timothy Snyder put it, bloodlands. It is what it is. And this is why we have our gallows humor, and this is why we are sometimes less professional and stuff. But, you know, it's a thing that we just do. This is how we cope.
Yeah, it's a different style. Well, thanks. Yeah, I think that answers all my questions. And I think, yeah, that's some of what I tried to get across both in my podcast and in my books about the Second World War in Ukraine, is that it was extremely complex, you know, and the Hollywood version where it's good guys versus bad guys just doesn't give you the understanding. That
yeah, I mean, that works, say, in France or in the Battle for Britain, air battles. There you can see like Nazis versus these people, but not in Eastern Europe. It's because of the weirdness of everything.
Yeah. Well, it's just so complex.
At any rate, I wanted to say a special thank you for inviting me over to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for coming on, Kristaps.
Of course. For my final words, I'd just like to say to everyone, comrades, of course, remember, happiness is mandatory.
Thank you very much, Kristaps. That, again, was Kristaps Andersens, the researcher, writer, and host of the Eastern Border podcast, which you can find on all your favorite podcasting apps, or find it on the web at easternborder.lv. Remember to like and follow his podcast. It's really informative. And remember to like and follow Beyond Barbarossa, this very podcast you're listening to right now. It's the only podcast in English about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. And like the Eastern Border, it's available on all podcasting apps. I'd also really appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you listen. It really helps spread the word to others interested in history. If you have any other comments or suggestions or questions or anything at all to add, just drop me a line but you can send an email to contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You can also find me, Scott Burry, author, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I want to thank you again for listening, and special thanks to all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. Remember, until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, Your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, this episode marks the first anniversary of this podcast. And we've been coming out most of the time regularly every 2 weeks. So after a year of doing this, 29 episodes plus bonus episodes, I'm going to take a short break. So look for the next episode, the first episode of season 2 of Beyond Barbarossa, in 4 weeks' time. So that'll be toward the end of July. I don't have a calendar in front of me right now. But if you follow the podcast on your preferred app, you'll get the notice when it goes live. And of course, you can always follow me on social media. I'm going to be posting lots of advance notice about when you can expect to see season 2, episode 1. And that's when I'll be taking a look at Case Blue, how it unfolded through the summer of 1942, leading up to the notorious Battle of Stalingrad. So enjoy your summer, everyone. Until next time, I remain your podcaster, Scott Burry. Till then, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina!